from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
I'm Rick Howlett, and this is In Conversation. Today, we're going to have a discussion about our recent history. The past 2 years have been a life-altering onslaught of big events. A pandemic, racial justice protests around the world, a stormy, sometimes chaotic election season, the storming of the U.S. Capitol. Where will these events fit into the big picture as the history texts are written and the decades go by? Who will write these accounts? We'll talk to two historians about it. Also, the coronavirus is surging again, this time to unprecedented levels driven by the Omicron variant. We'll talk with WFPL health reporter April Rickard about how health and government officials and others are responding to it. It's all ahead this hour on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Coming up later in the show, we're going to talk about how recent events in our country and world will be recounted by historians in the decades ahead. But first, as the latest coronavirus surge continues to grip us locally and nationally, we're going to get an update on the response to the huge spike in COVID cases caused by the Omicron variant. And joining us now is WFPL health reporter April Rickard, who's been doing a lot of reporting on this lately, as you can imagine. April, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. Thank you very much.
Well, we have quickly begun shattering records for COVID cases across the region. We are should let folks know we're taping this just ahead of Friday's program. Kentucky and surrounding states have seen soaring case numbers. We've learned some things from previous surges, including that, of course, hospitals can get overwhelmed. Generally speaking, there seems to be less severity of disease with this variant, but there's still a lot of concern about hospital capacity at this point, right?
That's right. And that's mainly because there have been records broken several times over the past 2 weeks in Kentucky and Indiana, just with the highest rise in cases that they've ever seen, breaking all records from the whole pandemic. So even though the disease, the Omicron variant, is less likely to cause a serious illness, just the sheer number of cases that they're seeing, positive cases, is going to mean more people in hospitals, and it's going to mean more healthcare workers out as well.
So this variant is much more contagious than the previous one, the Delta one, right?
That's right.
And I guess holiday gatherings, despite the fact this is very contagious, holiday gatherings, of course, didn't help and probably made things a lot worse.
Yes, from what I'm hearing from doctors, they expected a surge after the holidays, and it just so happens that Omicron hit around the holidays. So I think that the driver is more so just how contagious Omicron is rather than a lot of holiday gatherings, although that definitely contributed to it from what I'm hearing.
Well, we've had a surge of cases, and now we're seeing a surge in people trying to get COVID tests, both the at-home test and a lab test. You reported that some areas are rationing the at-home test. I believe that was Indiana, wasn't it?
Yes. Earlier this week, the State Department of Health gave the directive to local health departments that they midweek should stop giving the rapid test to anyone unless they were 18 and under or 50 and older with symptoms. And that's just because they have fewer of those, and so they want to give them to people who may need them more. And of course, the rapid tests take about 15 minutes. The PCR test can take a few days.
Now, the at-home tests, how reliable are they? How much faith do health officials put in these tests?
From what I've heard, they can detect a positive, but if you're having symptoms, especially if it could be on, to not necessarily trust a negative and to seek out a PCR test or a clinical test at a testing site in that case. But they say that if you do get a positive test at home and you have symptoms, assume that you're positive. You don't need to go out and get another PCR test at that point, because that could just further expose other people.
Have we seen any effort here in the Louisville area and that you know of other than that across our region to expand drive-through testing and laboratory testing in response to this increased demand for testing?
Yes, I don't have specifics on that, but there have been new large sites announced. I think in our area, Churchill Downs will start in the coming days as a mass testing site.
Yeah, we had these big clinics in the initial phase, and I believe Churchill Downs is going to open like six lanes, I believe they said, on Monday. But let's turn to vaccinations for a moment. Being vaccinated and boosted, as we've heard, does not guarantee that you won't catch the virus, but the unvaccinated tend to have the more severe cases, right?
Yes, that's what I'm hearing. Doctors and hospitals are saying almost all of their cases, 80%, 90% or more of COVID cases they're seeing are people who are unvaccinated. And there have been some breakthrough cases of vaccinated people, but for the most part, they're just not as serious. So they're also reporting younger people who are dying from COVID who are not vaccinated.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL. We're talking about the latest coronavirus surge with April Rickert, who is the health reporter for WFPL and also reports for our Kentucky Public Radio partner stations. As this latest surge pushing more people to get vaccinated, April, have we seen any statistics on that in Kentucky?
The vaccinations do seem to be going up, but more so are boosters. More people are getting boosters in recent weeks than they had before, and there are more child vaccinations at this point too, since they were approved about a month ago.
Now, these boosters have health officials indicated how long these might be good for? I think if you were 6 months out from your second vaccination, that you needed to get the booster. Is that going to be the same length of effectiveness for this booster, or do we know yet?
I haven't heard much on that yet. I've asked a few people this week if there's a second booster potential coming, and I just don't think it's on the radar yet. I think it could be soon. Discussions of that.
What about the availability of therapeutics in the last 2 years? Some have been developed. We've heard that some are not effective against Omicron, and I think there was a limited supply of the previous ones. What do we know at this point about those and how available they are in our area?
Governor Andy Beshear said earlier this week that the state would stop using two of the therapeutics that they had been using just because they're not effective on Omicron, and Omicron is what's mainly driving the surge right now. There are two new pills on the market that the state is going to start rolling out, but it's going to be pretty limited for the first few weeks, at least.
With these surges, there's a peak, then a plateau, and then a decrease in cases. Are officials offering any timeline, any estimates on how this particular peak will last?
From what I'm hearing, they're saying that we're kind of in the middle of the beginning, and they expect it to keep rising for maybe another week to two, a big surge in the next week to two, and then start to taper off a couple weeks after that.
I know we're still fighting through the Omicron variant, but are there any other variants on the horizon that you're hearing about?
No, that's the one that's mainly talked about right now. There's a little bit of news right now about something called Flurona, which is the flu and COVID combined. But in our area, I don't think we've seen a whole lot of that yet, or it hasn't caused a lot of problems as far as what I've heard.
Well, we're not seeing government restrictions with this surge, even though the numbers are much higher than they were initially, like we saw in that initial outbreak in 2020. Of course, we've learned a lot since then, and there's been some litigation limiting some governor's power since then, including here in Kentucky. But masking is still strongly urged indoors, isn't it, as this goes on?
Yes, that's right. And even over the past week, health officials have urged not just wearing a mask, but wearing a good mask, wearing an N95 or something similar to that, not just a surgical mask or a cloth mask, just because of the filtration level.
Do you personally, I kind of measure all of this by how the seriousness of all this by how many people I actually see out in public wearing masks. Is it something, have you seen here in the past week or so more people in public in stores and things like that wearing masks?
Well, honestly, I've been in public less the past week myself, but I think before that, I'd started to see more masking two or so weeks ago.
All right. April Rickard is health reporter for WFPL. April, thank you so much for your input. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Before we take a break on In Conversation, a couple of other pandemic developments to pass along. Governor Andy Beshear announced Thursday that Kentucky prison wastewater testing shows significant COVID-19 outbreaks. Beshear said people will be separated based on test results and symptoms.
No visitation is going to be allowed in the next, and we hope it's a couple days, but at least until we get a firm grasp on the outbreak.
The outbreak came as Kentucky is again dealing with the highest number of coronavirus cases since the pandemic began. On Thursday, the state's positivity rate was nearly 24%. A federal appeals court has declined to lift a three-state ban on President Joe Biden's COVID-19 vaccine mandate for federal contractors. That ruling came after a nationwide ban on the mandate for federal contractors was imposed by a federal judge in Georgia last month. A judge in Louisville in November issued the preliminary injunction that blocked the mandate. It includes two other states, Tennessee and Ohio. A panel of the Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals upheld the injunction in a 2-1 ruling on Wednesday. The lawsuit from the states claims the vaccination requirement is unlawful and unconstitutional. And the CDC issued new COVID-19 isolation and quarantine recommendations last week. And as WFPL's Yasmin Juma tells us, experts say they'll most likely disadvantage frontline workers.
The CDC cut the isolation time from 10 to 5 days for people who test positive and are either asymptomatic or have resolving symptoms. Dustin Pugel is with the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy.
When folks have to choose between keeping their job or earning a paycheck and going into work sick, we know that most of them will choose to go into work sick.
Pugel says low-wage workers, like with restaurant and retail jobs, often face this difficult decision. He says not being able to afford time off to care for their well-being isn't just a threat to them, but to public health, too. A 2021 report from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics showed workers in Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi had the least access to paid sick leave in the country. Dr. Keisha Bentley Edwards is an associate professor of medicine at Duke University.
It creates that push and pull because the CDC says you can come back to work in 5 days, even though your body may say, I'm not fit to work right now.
Bentley Edwards says the new recommendations assume a perfect system when it comes to testing access and well-intentioned employers. I'm Yasmin Juma in Louisville.
Still ahead on In Conversation, after our break, we'll turn our attention to how the pandemic and other recent events will be viewed by history in the decades ahead. You'll hear our discussion with two historians. First, Dr. Tracy K. Meyer at the University of Louisville, and then Brandon Renders, who's a Kentucky native. He's pursuing his PhD in history at the University of Texas and will soon be a history professor. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Well, as we look forward to a new year, and we hope a better year, we thought it would be interesting to assess the last couple of years in the context of history. How do you think the tumultuous events of those years, the pandemic, racial justice protests spurred by police violence, a violent insurrection at the nation's capital days before the transfer of power, how will they be remembered in the decades ahead? And how will those accounts be written? Who will write them? Well, joining us now to talk about it is Dr. Tracy K. Meyer, professor of history at the University of Louisville. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, let me start with a general question about history. In your view, at what point does something become history? I mean, do we need to put a certain amount of hindsight between us and that in order to have a fully realized or fair assessment of its historical significance? What's your view on that?
Yeah, I'm actually glad you asked that, because I think that the answer is yes. I think, and my own experience as a teacher, I think, informs how quickly I answer that question. Historians do like to have some critical distance, right? We want to be able to see patterns. We want to see relationships. And you often can't do that in the moment or even very close to the moment. So, for example, I teach the introductory level class that is in the catalog will say 1865 to present. But I always tell my students that historians get a little squirrely when we get to about the most recent decade, that we're not completely comfortable talking about things until a couple years have passed and we've had some opportunity to have that distance.
Well, right now, most of us view the events of the past few years as really big, quite significant. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, do you think with the passage of time that will kind of soften or change a little bit?
I think that always changes a little bit. I think that so much, because it's impossible to see when you're in an event where it's going, right? And history is always written or understood or taught from the point of view of the present. So when historians look back at the past, they're always sort of looking for patterns or clues to how we got to where we are. And so some events that may seem really significant today may become less significant depending on how things turn out, or may become more significant. That can happen too. Maybe 10 years from now, we look back and some of the things that today maybe we don't pay much as much attention to may be like, oh, wow, that was really important in the future.
Who's writing and recording history now? Some of us of a certain age have this kind of a fixed image of an older white man, perhaps wearing a bow tie, writing down these events in longhand. I mean, is there diversity now in history departments? Are you seeing a diversity of students interested in pursuing history for a career in teaching or writing or research?
I think the answer is yes, but yes, it is certainly more diverse than what you're describing. I think we still have a long way to go. Certainly, one of the big changes, even in my career, has been the number of women in the profession and in the teaching positions, which is now close to about 50-50, whereas when I first started out, it was not the case. We also have more, I think one of the big changes is people from different, not just racial and ethnic backgrounds, but economic backgrounds. Again, that has really changed over time that, it's not just economic elite that go into being professors as it might have been in an earlier day. And definitely more racial and ethnic diversity. I think that, like I said, that could definitely still be improved. There's still, for example, African Americans make up far less than their percentage in the general population in the in academia in general and in history specifically.
Well, I want to talk about perspective a little more when it comes to the racial related events that we've had. But I want to start with COVID, the coronavirus. Not just a public health and medical event, obviously, and a milepost in our history, but, it's been a societal and cultural event. It's raised religious arguments. It's, of course, a political issue. It has and will continue to influence elections. So, if you had to write a book or article about it in the years ahead, what approach interests you? What approach would you take?
Well, it's actually interesting you ask that because I teach this introductory level class, I really struggled over the last year with, what to say about COVID in class. And so I have actually redesigned the end of the semester so that the last day of class, we use COVID, we talk about the COVID crisis to talk about the themes of the class. So what does the COVID crisis tell us about the United States' role in the world. Because one of the questions we talk about is the United States more of a cooperator or more of an isolator internationally? And how has that changed over time? And the COVID crisis, of course, sheds light on that. I think the most obvious one that you just alluded to is the big question when we study modern U.S. history is the changing role of the federal government in society and in daily life. And I think one way that historians will look at COVID in the future is as a flashpoint in that debate, right? Like you said, it will be looked at as a public health crisis, but it will also be looked at as a flashpoint in the debate over what is the role and the extent of power of the federal government in people's lives.
There's also been this intersection between COVID and the way we go about our daily lives. More people, working from home. You know, this morning we had our daily news meeting via video on Google Meet. There was no in-person interaction at all. 12 to 15 people. It was totally routine, like we've been doing it for years. And you know, not long ago, the idea of doing this every day would have seemed strange. So there's that aspect of it too.
Yeah, and I think that even with my students, one thing I've noticed is before COVID, maybe one or two students took notes, brought a computer to class to take their notes. Now every single student does it. Right?
Yeah.
I think that there has been so one of the things that we may, like I said, it's, you have to sort of look back at the past for what goes on, between now and then. But in the future, we may very well back at this time as a real cultural change when, the patterns of where people worked and lived changed, where, my optimistic side says we will look back at this time period and say, science really progressed and we were able to identify variants and respond to them nimbly. And there was a cultural change in people's willingness to, take public health precautions. That's my optimistic side. There's a more negative way, potentially, you could look back on this time period, but I won't dwell on that. So,
well, we talk about the pandemic of 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, 1918, and there were some political overtones to that as well, right?
Right. Yes, and actually, this is an interesting example, I think, of how historians look back, because really, before the last 2 years, American history textbooks, American history classes barely mentioned the flu of 1918. If you were teaching a class on World War I, you would not have mentioned it. It would not have come up. Now, it of course does get mentioned, and it is used as an example of the tension at the time over the role of the government. Because, of course, this was at the peak of the progressive movement. And one of the things the progressive movement, that large P, progressive movement, did was advocate for government intervention in protecting labor rights, in giving women the right to vote, in regulating the workplace, safety in the workplace. So there was a big debate going on at that time about what the role of government, state government, and federal government. And so you could see, if you look back at that now, people resisted mandates, right? People resisted wearing masking. People resisted some of the what we would call stay-at-home orders, but I don't think they used that same language then. It's very similar to today, actually.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett, and we're talking with Professor Tracy K. Meyer from the University of Louisville, Department of History, talking about the historic context of the various events we've seen over the past few years, major events in our history, and how they'll be viewed decades down the road. You know, the arguments over vaccines and masking have in some ways illustrated our division as a nation, because they seem more often than not to fall along political lines, which seemed to grow more stark. And I will go back to the 2016 election. You know, we'd been divided then, but that seemed to mark a point where the gloves really came off in the Trump election, empowered, certain radical segments on the right to fly their flag, literally and figuratively. And that in turn fueled racial tensions that exploded after the police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others. I mean, do you see that? I mean, is that your assessment of what happened then? These divisions have really been laid bare?
Yes. And I think that, when historians look back, we'll see that there's this, I think there's a cycle So my husband and I are actually writing a American history book that looks at American history as a conflict between struggles for racial justice, struggles for equal citizenship on the one hand, and backlashes against those struggles on the other. And we can see this has happened repeatedly in the 20th century with the 1920s, with the rise of the Klan and anti-immigration legislation, and then with the Cold War being a backlash against the New Deal and sort of rising ideas about racial equality during the war. And of course, more famously, the rise of the New Right, being a reaction against the movements of the 1960s. And part of me says we're in another one of those cycles, right? We're in a cycle that's, you know, a backlash against, again, rising immigration, against the election of Barack Obama, against the sort of more assertive voices from people of color. There's always been a population in the country that resisted social change, that resisted advances in equal citizenship, but there's a platform that's so much larger now.
Yeah. You've written about race and integration here in Louisville, and the right. of course, the protests that spilled into the streets in the summer of 2020 were something mm-hmm. we hadn't seen since really the busing protests of the 70s and, mm-hmm. of course, as you mentioned, the civil rights movement of the 60s. In terms mm-hmm. of Louisville's history and its future, I mean, would you consider this a major historical event? And who do you think, who's around that's going to be writing that history, going back to, you know, whose perspective we're going to have for that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my first gut response is I hope so, right? That I hope that, you know, one of the things that impressed me at the time during those demonstrations was the sort of breadth of people coming out for them, and not just coming out for them physically, because a lot of people weren't comfortable doing that because we were in the middle of a pandemic, but the amount of people that expressed support for them in different ways. And I think, you know, my more, again, sort of on the more optimistic side of what is different about this cycle of backlash against racial justice is that is demography. There are not only are there more people of color, people who are seeking racial justice, but more white people are allying with that and supporting it and refusing to defend, you know, white supremacy, right? I think that's national, but it's also in Louisville. When you looked at those demonstrations, they were very multiracial. They were very age diverse. They, you know, all kinds of representation from religious groups, from non-religious groups. And so that gave me a lot of hope. My concern is that we haven't seen a lot of concrete results from it yet. We've seen some symbolic results, you know, a lot of people expressing support and stuff. And we did see a little bit of, you know, with the Breonna's Law and the no-knock warrant stuff, but we haven't really seen sort of a lot of results in terms of, you know, structural change yet. You know, so the jury's out, and so to speak. So this is why historians don't like to talk about things too close to the present, right? Because we don't know yet. But I do think that it has the potential because of, you know, that sort of broad alliance that showed up. I think does have a potential. I don't think the potential has been acted on yet.
Well, speaking of closeness to an event, the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol a year ago, and you know, that night in Congress, there was almost, you know, universal condemnation of the rioters and of President Trump, including his allies at the time. But as you probably heard in the months since then, there's been quite a softening of opinion about exactly what happens. You know, some referring to the rioters even as tourists. So, you know, I just wonder how this is going to be viewed, you know, decades down the line.
I actually think, and this is one that I actually have thought about more in terms of trying to picture 10 years from now, what are historians saying? And I actually think, because a lot of times people say, you know, what's the comparison in American history to this? And, you know, so historians don't really like to do that because every time period really is unique. But there really isn't a comparison in modern U.S. history to this, to that event and that reaction. I mean, really, you have to go back to the Civil War, because what you're talking about is one political faction
claiming that the other is illegitimate, not just wrong, not just mistaken, but illegitimate, right? And we haven't seen that since the Civil War. And so that really does, I think, concern me. And as a historian, again, looking for parallels, even during the height of the Cold War, when, you know, anti-communists were talking about the other as illegitimate, you weren't talking about sort of mainstream, you know, majority. You were talking about a tiny minority of people. Here you have Republicans essentially claiming that the majority is illegitimate, right?
Yeah.
And I think that it does share with some rhetoric from the past, the sort of othering of someone you disagree with as being not quite American, as being not quite sharing good values. You know, you see that kind of language, you know, recurringly through American history, that your opponent is somehow not really an American, right? I could try to laugh at the extent to which people are throwing around the term communist and socialist for anybody they disagree with, except it's not really funny. But I think that the extent now of basically saying, you know, Democrats, liberals, progressives are not legitimate whenever they win, right? That is a sort of unique situation in modern American history.
So these things are happening as you're teaching history. How do you work these in? Do you say, well, we were going to talk about this today, but now we're going to talk about it in this context, given what's happened?
Yeah. Carefully, for one. I should say right off the bat, carefully, because I do work at a public institution. And, you know, if the teaching evaluations start saying, oh, she brings up politics too much, you know, that could be bad. Right. So I try not to be too overt, but I will have an interesting moment when I was teaching the 1968 election. And one of the things I was talking about was the George Wallace candidacy and how, even though he was from the South and, you know, some of his defense of segregation, you know, some of the places where he got a lot of votes were rural Wisconsin, rural Pennsylvania, and rural Michigan. And this was 2 days after the 2016 election. Right. And I didn't have to say anything. You could see students in the back go, oh. See, that's that. It's not a north-south divide. It's a rural-urban divide. Mm. And it's like, I didn't have to say, just like Trump did, right? Which I'm not sure would even be appropriate. But the students could see that historical parallel without it having to be spoon-fed to them.
Well, it looks like we'll have some interesting times ahead. Mm-hmm. Professor Tracy K. Meyer, thanks so much for joining us, Professor of History at the University of Louisville. We'll be back with more after a break. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville, and we're continuing our discussion in this first week of 2022 of how the past couple of years will be recalled and chronicled by the writers of history in the decades ahead. We're going to narrow our focus for this segment to race and the racial justice protests that were prompted by the police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others in the U.S., and institutional changes that have been made or promised in the weeks and months since. Joining us now is someone who's likely to be writing and teaching some of these historical accounts. Brandon James Render is a PhD student in the Department of History at the University of Texas, Austin.
He completed his bachelor's degree in history and social studies at Western Kentucky University and his master's degree at Eastern Kentucky University. His dissertation is called Colorblind University, Race and Higher Education in the 20th Century. Brandon, welcome to In Conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's no problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, you are at an interesting intersection for the subject of our conversation. You're a historian, you're a Kentuckian, and you're a black man. Let me start by learning a little bit more about you. What part of Kentucky are you from?
So I grew up in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Yeah, so the South Central region, and both of my families are from Western Kentucky. So I kind of consider Western Kentucky to be sort of like a broader home to me.
So what are you doing now as a historian and a student? I mentioned your dissertation and you are a PhD candidate. Is there a particular discipline in history that you're studying?
Really American history in general. I focus on social and intellectual history. I look at the ways in which social movements have changed the way that we think about different aspects of society. In this case, for my dissertation, I look at how social movements during the mid-20th century, so the civil rights movement and the black power movement, have changed the way that we think about race. And so in this case, I more so think about how we've transitioned from race-conscious segregation in the early 20th century to this idea of colorblindness, where we should eliminate racial categories in order to achieve racial equality.
And you are applying that, I believe, in your dissertation to higher education. I want to talk a little bit about that a little later. But just to start off, you've obviously witnessed the events of the last couple of years, either in person or from a distance in your position where you are now. But based on what you've seen 100 years from now, how do you think history will view the Black Lives Matter movement and compared to, say, the civil rights movement that you mentioned of the 60s?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think about this as a historian, but I also just think about this as somebody who moves about in the world and has to navigate all of these social and political conflicts that everyone, in a sense, has to deal with in some way. And so I think that there are a few different parallels between the civil rights movement of the 1960s and then the contemporary Black Lives Matter movement, and really the broader racial equity campaign that we're seeing today. And so the first thing that I noticed is how social media basically is a tool that people use for racial justice activism. And so in some cases, like with the George Floyd video, maybe the person who took that video didn't realize that at that time that was a part of activism, but it's true that it is. And so thinking about this in terms of the civil rights movement, we can think about how television networks frame civil rights. And so you can think about this as how TV networks either expanded the discussion or the narrative on civil rights or in some ways restricted it. And so whenever it comes to the expansion of the civil rights movement, you can think about the ways in which, for instance, the Selma March in March of 1965 was captured on nationwide television. They actually interrupted the movie Judgment at Nuremberg to show what was happening at the Edmund Pettus Bridge as law enforcement officers were engaging in a violent response to peaceful black protesters. And so we can think about that, the connection between the civil rights movement and TV networks in the 1960s, but then also how social media helps perpetuate much of the activism that we see today with the contemporary Black Lives Matter movement. So another interesting parallel that I've noticed as well is global conflict. And so in the 1960s, we were in the midst of the Cold War, and then that manifested in the Vietnam War in the mid-1960s. Today, it's sort of a different global conflict where we're not necessarily talking about military intervention, but the COVID-19 pandemic. And so when everything shut down, this gave people more of an opportunity to have to sit with these ideas of racial justice and inequity. And I think it, in many ways it forced people to act. And so, you know, back in the 1960s, a lot of people questioned many of the civil rights motives, not from the actual civil rights activists, but the U.S. government's response to it. And so essentially what people were saying is, how can the U.S. government, which is engaging in this Cold War conflict with with Soviet Russia, how can they argue that we should expand democracy worldwide whenever people at home, particularly Black Americans, but really people of color in general, are denied even the basic right to vote? And so I think a lot of people are also thinking about this, not just in the 1960s as it relates to the civil rights movement and the Cold War, but today whenever it comes to racial justice and the COVID-19 pandemic. I think a lot of people recognize that since this is a public health crisis that affects everyone throughout the world, that it's going to take a collective response in order to overcome the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think that people are understanding that that whenever it comes to police brutality and really violence in general, that it's going to take a collective response in order to mediate many of these conflicts that do end up in violent confrontations, whether it's between law enforcement officers and ordinary citizens, or like in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, where it's vigilante violence, so ordinary citizens engaging in violence towards each other.
Earlier in the program, I talked about this with Dr. Tracy K. Myers, a history professor at the University of Louisville. I posed this question to her, and I want to ask you as well. How do you view something as historical? How much hindsight do you think should be put between an event and when you decide to call it history and refer back to it and chronicle it?
Yeah, that's another great question. So the way that I view this is, you know, there are a lot of historians that may put an actual date on it. You know, you have to be 20 or 30 years from an event to actually be able to look back at it and consider it to be history. But for me, I don't think that there's a specific time period. I think it's more so how can we evaluate the results of that time period. And so for my specific research, I look at race in higher education. And so for my dissertation, it goes all the way up until 2003. And so there were two monumental cases, both of which occurred within the context of admissions decisions at the University of Michigan, which really framed this idea of how should we use race when it comes to higher education admissions, but also what is the relationship between race and education, specifically at colleges and universities, look like. And so despite the fact that that case was technically, those cases were decided 18 years ago, I think that we've been able to adequately describe what those results are, but then also how it's continued to push through this idea of how should we use race in education, especially whenever you look at contemporary cases, whether it was the case that was decided about 5 years ago at the University of Texas in Fisher v. Texas, or the current case that is going on right now with the Students for Fair Admissions v. Harvard trial, which is should be decided by the Supreme Court by the end of this judicial year. And so I don't necessarily put a date or a number on it. I just think we have to, as historians, how much separation do we have from these specific historical events or ideas that we're talking about to really talk about what they result in or what is the culmination of these ideas?
Who, from your perspective, are the next generation of historians? And I asked Dr. K. Meyer about this as well. Is there, in your experience, is there more diversity in history departments and among writers and researchers? Are you seeing that?
So I'm seeing it in some ways, but then not so much in others. And so one of the unfortunate things about the pandemic is that a lot of institutions of higher education had to limit the funding that they offered to specific departments to which they could bring in graduate students. And so there were a number of departments over the past year or two who haven't brought in the number of historians that they want to bring in. But then the smaller pools of graduate students that eventually go on to become historians or professionals. This leads to a smaller and less diverse pool. And so we'll have to see how, you know, a few years from now, how this turns out with graduation rates and what it looks like whenever it comes to the number of historians broken down by demographic categories, how the pandemic and the restrictions placed on departments because of financial restrictions, how that plays a role in the diversity of the profession. But I think that there could be more historians of color. I do believe that there could be more feminist historians, people non-American historians that study in America, but then also look at different world or different geographies. And so I think that there's much more that we could do as historians to diversify the profession and expand the way that we think about history, but in a way that really challenges the profession to grow and really seek out new territory to study and ask questions that maybe we've never asked before.
How's your experience down at University of Texas Austin? Are there other young people of color like you who are interested in going into history?
Yeah, so there are a number of students of color that are in the department here at the University of Texas, but we've tried to work on other things. Like, for example, there have been fewer women that have come into the department, and so we're working on finding a good gender balance to make sure that it's not a male-dominated department. I'm also part of the Anti-Racism Action Committee, which works to develop new equity and inclusion measures that the department can install to ensure that we're not just talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion in higher education today, but how we can use that moving forward to make sure that we're not continuing to have the same discussions and looking at how inequity continues to affect higher education, but actually providing solutions to what we can do as both historians, but then also as people who, you know, want to see the expansion of education and provide access for anybody who wants to go to college, who wants to seek advanced degrees, no matter their socioeconomic status, their race, their nationality. We want to make sure that these opportunities are available for everyone and not just a select few.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL. We're talking with Brandon Render about history and how the big events of the past few years will be recalled and chronicled by the writers of history in the decades to come. Brandon's a PhD student at the Department of History at the University of Texas Austin. He has degrees from Western and Eastern Kentucky universities and is a Kentucky native. Well, the thing about history, the thing that seems to be, what seemed to me to be challenging as a student and as a teacher, as you're trying to get your PhD or you're teaching, that history continues to unfold right in front of you, and you're always trying to fold it into what you're doing. I know your dissertation addresses race and higher education, color blindness, but how do you think future historians will view the current controversy that's been erupting in recent months about the teaching of what many call critical race theory?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I actually think, you know, going back to your previous question about the similarities between the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the contemporary racial justice movement, I think one of the things that I didn't mention before, but we see both back then and now, is this idea of resistance. And so there was a massive resistance campaign that occurred in the 1960s to prevent civil rights gains. And I think that we're also seeing that today. Back during the summer of 2020, there were two books that really dominated discussions on anti-racist activism. And so those two books are Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist and Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility. And so this was a way to frame anti-racism education, but then continue the conversation, even in moments that aren't as politically or socially heightened as they are right after the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor killings. And so with the popularity of those two books and then the expansion of anti-racism education, I think that's where much of this critical race theory debate comes from. I think that on one side, there were people that were looking for new ways to think about what is currently happening in the U.S. and trying to understand not just police brutality, but racial inequality in general. But then on the flip side of that, you had politically conservative, either ordinary Americans or even policymakers that were looking for ways to prevent the perpetuation or expansion of anti-racist education. And so in order to do that, they had to develop this, to me, it's a manufactured crisis whenever it comes to critical race theory. As many people know and as many people have discussed, critical race theory is not taught in schools. And so in order to get people to oppose critical race theory, I think, in many ways, people had to manufacture this conflict to say, not only are they teaching these in colleges and teaching critical race theory in colleges and universities, but we're also teaching young children this. And so people were in many ways imagining this conflict to trickle all the way down to children, which are, you know, one of the most vulnerable groups in the U.S. And so people were trying to figure out ways to ensure that anti-racism education could be prevented. And so that's had significant impact on what we do as historians, because there's always been sort of a push to prevent the academic freedom that many people enjoy at colleges and universities, whether this is the passage of legislation at the state and federal level, or even just sort of vigilante efforts like campus watch groups or doxing that occurs that prevents not just graduate students, but also professors from discussing certain ideas that relate to anti-racist education. And so, like you say, not only does the history change, but also the way that people view history changes. And so we also have to deal with the backlash that comes with that as well, specifically how people either try to promote certain ideas in relation to how history is unfolded, or how people try to prevent those ideas from being discussed either inside or outside of the classroom. And so it's sort of a twofold effort with trying to keep up with how history changes and how history is viewed politically, but then also the different conflicts that we have to navigate whenever it comes to actually being able to carry out our jobs as historians.
Well, we've been talking about history. I want to talk a little bit about your future. Can you tell us where you are in your PhD journey and what your plans are following that?
Yeah, so I just, I'll be finishing up my PhD in the coming semester. I'll graduate in May. And then in the fall, I'll be an assistant professor at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City.
Well, congratulations.
Yes.
It's been good talking to you, Brandon, and we wish you well in your studies and your career as a historian. And thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is a really great opportunity to have a cool discussion. So thank you.
That's Brandon Render, PhD student at the Department of History at the University of Texas, and he joins us from Austin. I want to thank our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyreen Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, and Russell Wells. Our local news is anchored by Bill Burton. Our opening and closing theme was composed by Kojin Toshiro, and I'm Rick Howland. Thanks for listening.